All right, we're back on WIMS 1420 AM, your talk of the South Shore. This is Veterans Unplugged. I'm your host, Vince Emanuele. This next conversation that you will hear is an interview I conducted a couple weeks ago with author, philosopher, poet of the ecological movement, Mr. Derek Jensen. The topic of the interview is empire, and I will have some brief comments after the interview is over. The interview should run for about 67, 68 minutes. So enjoy.
First, let us discuss your conception of empire. When did you first conceptualize the term or concept of empire, and whose work influenced your understanding of empire, some of your main influences?
I think empire has a pretty sort of standard definition, and the problem is that some people think it's a good thing. But empire is basically the notion of having a governing system. You know, we can call it a state at this point, but it can also you can have empires that are tribal too. It's basically a state that's based on conquest, and you know that's what the Roman Empire was. And it's a governing unit that is based on colonies, and I'm having colonies, not theft from the poor. And if I had to cite what I think is the most succinct sort of statement about it, it would be the anthropologist Stanley Diamond's statement that, quote, civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. Civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. And, you know, some people obviously would disagree with the word civilization, but we'll set that aside for a second because we're talking about empire. And everybody would agree that empire originates in conquest abroad and repression. And that's what empires do. That's what the Roman Empire did. That's what the Greek Empire did. That's what the British Empire did. The United States Empire does. That's the definition of an empire. And the reason for the conquest abroad is that you need colonies in order to maintain a lavish lifestyle. And this is something that we've seen, you know, all through the history of empires. And, you know, the Greek democracy was based on, I don't remember the numbers, I'm making up the numbers here, but let's say, you know, 70% of the people were enslaved. Excuse me, I got caught. Yeah, some huge percentage of the people were enslaved. And the word slave itself comes from the same word as Slavic, because the Romans got so many of their slaves from the Slavic region. And that's, once again, how does anyone think that the U.S. economy, I mean, the U.S. economy could not exist without the theft of resources from the colonies. And this is how it's been from the beginning. Rome could not have existed without the theft of resources from the colonies. So that's pretty much where I go from on empire. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, definitely. If you could maybe add some more influences, people you might read now on the topic, anyone in particular in the past who's informed your thinking on at least the basic concept itself. I guess I could think of folks in particular that I had read.
Who are some of the important ones for you?
I would say Chalmers Johnson was a big one. Mm-hmm. His book Blowback, and then the series Nemesis and Sorrows of Empire. Obviously, mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. Chomsky was a big one. Michael mm-hmm. Parenti, Howard Zinn is another one. Mm-hmm. Cornel West, mm-hmm. folks like this. More of the, I guess, people you get turned on to early on. People in the left, just prominent, you know, folks, intellectuals, public intellectuals.
Thank you for saying all that. And, you know, honestly, from my early understanding of empire, probably Z Magazine was pretty important, because I first discovered them when I first became politicized in really politicized in, 87, 88, 89, somewhere in there, in my late 20s. And then I subscribed for, probably close to 10 years. And then I haven't subscribed for the last 15 in great measure because, it's like, okay, I get it. The United States is an empire. But that was a real revelation for me because I hadn't been exposed to that literature when I was younger. So that was actually pretty important. And it's pretty interesting that you and I took this from a couple different directions that when I started talking about empire, I immediately started talking about history. And when you start talking about it, you went straight to current politics. And I find that really interesting. And I wonder if, I was extremely interested in history when I was growing up. And I mean, I read The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire when I was, 17 or something. 19. Anyway, I've always sort of seen this as a historical pattern. And in my book, Endgame, I talk about how, in A Language of Open Words, I talk about how the culture is really not going to change on a psychological level. And in Culture Make-Believe, I talk about how the system of social rewards in this culture leads to these sorts of atrocities, leads to colonialism, because it's an acquisitive social reward system. And in Endgame, I wanted to approach it from a different direction, which is the movement of resources. And because you can argue with psychology or sociology, but you can't really argue with movement resources, that you can't have an oil economy without having access to oil, and you can't have the only way you can exceed the local carrying capacity of a place is by having colonies, by stealing it from someplace else, by drawing down someplace else. People talk about having this wonderful windmill economy or solar economy, but those all require, there are parts of China that are these toxic lakes because of the pollution from rare earth mining. And, we all want to have a laptop, and I have a laptop, and those consumer electronics are the source of conflicts in Africa. There are a lot of coltan comes from Congo, and the conflicts there, including the mass rapes, can be directly related to the destruction of communities to steal their resources. And this is one more thing I want to say about empire before we move on. I know I'm sort of going topic to topic, but it's what I do, and for better or worse. And another thing I want to say about this is that even a lot of the people who oppose empire and who speak out against the U.S. imperial policies often don't recognize that this way of life requires empire. It's like so many of them want to still have an oil economy without, the United States military invading countries all over the planet to take their oil.
Sure.
And so many of these people, even who are very, very smart, don't make the connection between this level of consumption. I mean, the point is it has to come from somewhere. You hear people talk about how cities can be sustainable, blah, blah, blah. And we might get to that in a while because that has to do with the heart of empire too. But one thing is like, okay, if you're going to have electricity, it means you have to have mines because you can't have copper wiring without copper mines. And you can't have pop cans or beer cans or airplanes without having bauxite mines. And those have to be somewhere. And so a lot of people make the disconnect. They think that, just get rid of the car system and have high speed rail. It's like, okay, where do you get the metal for the rails? Where do you get the energy? I mean, it has to come from somewhere. And that's the essence for me of empire and the essence of colonialism and the essence of civilization is that conquest. That's where we get back, for me at least, it gets back to Stanley Diamond, where it originates in conquest abroad and repression at home, that it originates in that you can't have a lifestyle based upon massive consumption without – it's a zero-sum game. Somebody wins and somebody else loses, especially the non-human world loses at this point. So do I need to keep hammering this, or am I being even remotely coherent?
No. I think it's fine. I think touching on your point with America, I would say, you know, of course we've got 5% of the world's population, yet we use 25% of the world's resources, if not more. I think those facts, many people on the left are missing. So I think just having these conversations, and when you bring up a statistic like that, you know, folks kind of look at you sideways and you go, no, this is the reality. Yes. I mean, if you think that we're going to continue to build $400,000 homes and gated communities that cost, you know, whatever, however much to heat and cool a month, you're absolutely nuts. And then second, you know, on your point of history versus now, I think you're completely right. I think if more people in the country conceptualized America as an empire, and then not only envisioned America as an empire, but then also were able to place it in a historical context to understand that this has been going on since the creation of Western civilization, not to mention the Japanese empire, so on and so forth, I think that would do a lot of people on the left good. I think the reason I always bring up the current empire or the American empire, one, because I was a part of it, two, I think it's particularly pervasive right now, and the reason I say that is not just because of our military presence around the world, you know, 800 military bases, so on and so forth, but also our culture, the fact that kids in the Philippines celebrate Christmas with a white Santa Claus, and the fact that, you know, Coca-Cola is served in South America and McDonald's are opening up like crazy in China, I think is – unfortunately, as each empire has collapsed, they've also left a part of their culture with the world at large. And unfortunately, the culture we're going to leave behind is McDonald's bags and Coca-Colas. I don't mean to say that in a cynical fashion.
No, I think it's really true. And another thing I want to – and I think all your points are great. I want to be really clear, too, that I wasn't saying it's better that I was looking at history than at current. I was just saying it's pretty interesting. And that's another thing. It's the whole thing is, I'm going to use a word I don't really like to use, but the whole thing is kind of fractal, you know, in terms of no matter how you look at an empire, from the level of the patriarchal family unit up to the larger social unit, you know, it replicates itself all through the culture. And two more things about this. One of them is that I think, once again, that they would use different language, but even the most you know, pro neoliberal person, and whether they're liberal or conservative, you know, Democrat, Republican, whatever, they would in the end be forced to agree with the notion of empires being based on conquest, except they wouldn't use that word. It would be empires based, you know, the United States is not an empire because instead they merely protect their strategic interests. But protecting strategic interests is just another way of saying protecting access to those resources. So when you get through all the language, when you cut down to actually what's happening, most everyone running this culture would agree with the definition we've given of empire. But then where we would separate, I believe, is in our perspective on whether it is a good or bad thing. And I think, unfortunately, the whole white man's burden continues to this day. White Man's Burden was written by Rudyard Kipling about basically how tough it is to be a white man in this world, because you have to civilize all the savages. You have to go in and you have to lift them up and teach them our ways. And this is just a heavy burden we have to carry. And he wasn't saying this ironically at all. And then today, you know, the president can say, you know, not ironically at all, that they're bringing freedom and democracy to the world. And it's the same old white man's burden. But they would, once again, consider this a good thing, that they would consider this maintenance of strategic access to strategic, you know, strategic resources. They would consider that, once again, a good and necessary thing. And they would also consider their their interactions with the people in these other countries to be positive to the others. I mean, look at the word development, non-developed nations and developed nations. I don't ever use the word development for that because unless it's like I'm trying to communicate something and somebody just won't understand it either way, or like a developer. A developer turns forests and meadows into suburbs. But the word development really means to become something more full, to become something better. You know, a child, I'm not saying an adult's better than a child, but a child develops into an adult. A moth developed from a caterpillar. That's you know, a butterfly develops from a caterpillar, and that's development is a sort of natural process, you know, stages of human development as we go from infancy through adulthood. And that's a good and natural thing. So one of the things they're doing is they are making it, instead of calling it industrialization or calling it colonialism like they used to, now they call it development. And the point is that that word is implying that it's actually better for those locals. And they so often get so many people to buy into this when it's so often not true. So many people around the world don't want it's not until their cultures have been destroyed that they want this culture instead. This is why indigenous peoples fight, and they to this day are continuing to fight to maintain their ways of living, and they're continuing to have their land stolen, just like always. That was one thing. Oh, another thing I wanted to say, how pervasive this is. I don't know if you've ever played like Civilization, the computer game, or Cossacks was one. A lot of those games, Risk for that matter. I mean, the point is to conquer the world, and Risk is a great game of empire. It's all about empire. You want to build up your forces, and then you conquer other places. As you conquer them, you get more resources. In this case, more military resources. And it's just a classic game of empire. This is what, and my point is that how you win in these is by taking over everything. And that's the level at which it's taught, is at the level of that it pervades every level of our culture. And I mean, you think about this. I saw this. I don't know if I mentioned this last time we did an interview. It just blows me away. And this happens all the time. You see this in nature programs where they project this onto the natural world. There was this program I saw a couple of years ago about ancient bears, you know, 12,000 years ago or something. I don't know how long, a long time ago. And two things about it just blew me away. One of them, they kept talking about these bears invading each other's territory, like an army. And they would talk about it. And they would have scary music as this bear. And you find out this is like over 1,000 years. It's just sort of the habitat changed and the bears move with the habitat. And then the other part was that they kept saying this one bear is so scary. It has these big, strong jaws and they put on this terrifying music every time it comes on. And it's not until the end that they tell you that the reason this bear has such strong jaws is because it's a scavenger. And it needs to break the bones of dead caribou. It's not even scary jaws at all. It doesn't do anything with them except, I mean, as long as you're alive, it's not going to do anything to you. And my point is that this is projected onto the natural world. You watch any of these nature programs, like The Conqueror, who is the king of the jungle? Who is the one who can conquer all? And it's this extraordinary projection and an attempt to naturalize this behavior that is not actually naturalized at all. It's very specific behavior to a very specific set of social rules. Social Darwinism is just that, you know, this notion, survival of the fittest. I mean, all that is this project, the same thing with the empire. That's the same language is used by the empires to rationalize conquest. Which culture is the strongest? Which one is the most fit? Which one can take over?
Absolutely.
It's the propaganda on this is at every level of our lives.
Now,
it's Christianity too. I mean, it's also the monotheistic idea, and it goes to our very epistemology on a couple of levels. That it's this notion that there can be one way to live, and this is the way that has to expand. What are missionaries? Missionaries are they're trying to bring people into this circle, into this one way to be. You know, McDonald's is a form of proselytization itself, not for Christianity, but for this one way to be, for capitalism in this case. And this goes to the very core One more thing, and then I'll shut up about this, which is that in my book Dreams, I wrote about how Richard Dawkins, the famous scientific philosopher, has said, quote, "Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command." And that's the same notion. Remember, it's based on conquest. It's based on civilization, empire is based on conquest. And making someone else jump through hoops on command is based on dominating them. And he's saying that's how we know science is true. So what he has done is conflated epistemology, and that's a fancy word, which means how we know something is true. How do we know what is true? He has conflated truth with domination. And that's an extraordinary, extraordinary conflation. That's how deeply this notion of conquest and power over and domination pervades this entire culture. It's infected our very notion of what we believe is true.
And
how we know something is true. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say conquering and manipulating our natural environment as opposed to living in unity with it, or at least attempting to.
Or just living with it. The philosopher John Livingston said that he thought that the goal of life is long-term, interspecific, coexistence. There we go. Long-term, interspecific coexistence. You know, that you live with your neighbors. The Talo Indians on his land I now live, they lived here for 12,500 years, and at least. And they didn't conquer their neighbors. They weren't conquered by their neighbors until the Europeans arrived, and they weren't their neighbors. And they lived here perfectly sustainably for 12,500 years. And that's an entirely different mindset would lead to that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Let's talk about how that mindset leads to not only the exploitation of resources from communities that would otherwise not be willing to allow for that destruction of their land base, but also the violence the widespread violence that in order to maintain this standard of living, not just here, but then also obviously you can take that into the natural environment or with other civilizations in the past, but particularly that violence.
Let's go with that question first. And I saw a study not long ago. A couple of things. One is I saw a study not long ago that there's a direct correlation between – there's a study done in Africa – a direct correlation between how resource-rich a country is and the basically the number of wars. So there's a one-to-one – not a one-to-one, a direct correlation between resource richness and military conflict. So – do you want to comment on that? I mean, do we really need a study to tell us this? I mean, we understand why that would happen, right?
Sure.
I mean, if they got resources, people are going to fight over them. If they have this sort of conquest mentality, if they don't have resources, you know, why would the United States have bases in Saudi Arabia if there weren't oil?
Sure. No, absolutely.
I mean, how many military bases do they have? I don't know. Where's a country with not a lot of resources? You know?
No.
I don't know. And so that's one part. Another part is I don't remember the exact numbers, so I'm making them up, but I'm within 20%. Like 60% of the countries experiencing famine at any time are actually food exporters. The Great Irish Potato Famine, we hear about that a lot, but the truth is Ireland was an exporter of food at that point to the British Empire. The British conquered. The British took all the good land and they used it for grain and they exported that. And the locals were forced to live on the poorest land and were forced to eat potatoes. And this is true for many African nations are at the same time they're experiencing severe famine, they're exporting lima beans to Europe, or they're exporting biofuels at this point. I just saw a study the other day that 2 days ago that somebody or another was saying that 120 million people will go hungry because of biofuels. And I would actually think that's probably a lot higher. So the point is that how does the violence from this way of life is based on. How does it end up happening? Well, think about this on a sort of any sort of personal level. If you and I are living in the same neighborhood and you happen to have some things that I want, say you're raising chickens, you know, say you're raising chickens and I happen to want some of those chickens and I don't want to give you a fair value for them. Or let's say you don't believe in selling chickens. Let's say you just live with the chickens and you eat some, but you don't believe in selling them. So I come to get some and you say, well, I can't give them to you because they don't, you know, they're their own beings. And so I want some, so I'm going to come take them. And then you and I can have a conflict over it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. And like right now, they're trying to put in the Belo Monte Dam and on the Xingu River, and the Kayapo and Juruno and other people are fighting it. And they're saying that if this dam goes in, our people will die and our people will lose our way of life. It's so easy for us in the United States to forget that people the world over have not adopted this way of life voluntarily. They have adopted it at the point of a gun, and they've adopted it when their resources have been stolen. And it's very easy for the elite to forget that, and the poor almost never do. The people who are being stolen from almost never do. Almost never forget that. You know, I just saw the other day, I don't remember who's saying this, but somebody was talking about Obama, and they were saying something about, will he be able to help us fulfill our manifest destiny? Remember I was saying how you and I would react in horror to the notion of what empire is, but a lot of people think it's positive. And, you know, even with all the work I've done, I've got 20 books out now all around these subjects, and I thought that the term manifest destiny had been, I thought nobody believed that was anything but a genocidal impulse anymore. But evidently there are some big politicos who still believe that this word is, this phrase is actually a good one.
If you listen to Obama's speech in Grant Park, which I was there just to get a load of what was going on, and I actually knew a small group of anarchist guys and gals that were running up and down the street trying to cause a ruckus, but there was like 20 of them, and there was 2.1 million people who were there to watch the speech. Needless to say, when he was making the speech, a large portion of that, he didn't explicitly say American exceptionalism, and he didn't explicitly say manifest destiny, but the rhetoric was there, and it was quite obvious. And he's spoken about this in the past as well. I mean, I think that not only is that mentality alive and well in the elites in the country, but I think that also arouses the worst in the people here in this country. That sort of,
I completely agree with you.
That patriotic fervor that gets people worked up to start bombing countries and occupying countries and so on and so forth. It really does bring out the worst, that sort of nationalist nonsense, in my opinion.
I agree with you. And what it's so easy to forget as we get our, as we maintain, as this way of life is maintained, is that these come from someone's home, including non-humans and including humans. Somebody already lives there. If you're deforesting, if you're putting in a mine, that's a sacrifice zone that is someone else's home. And, that's what empire is. Years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupacamaristas, a revolutionary group in Peru, the MRTA. And I asked, what do you want for the people of Peru? And the person said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's the entire struggle right there. That's really what this is about, is community autonomy the world over, that the people of the Zingo River need to be allowed to decide for themselves how they're going to live. You know, there's a referendum. It was on, now it might be off, down in Bolivia. What country is it? I'm blanking. Anyway, there's the lowlands, people, they're going to put in a road. I believe it's Bolivia.
It's Bolivia.
Thank you. They're going to put in a road, and it's going to cut through the heart of this forest where humans and non-humans live. And it struck me as just an appalling thing to put it to a referendum of not only those people, because why should the people who live elsewhere get a voice in determining what happens to that region in terms of putting a road through, in terms of harming it? The people of the highlands are going to receive economic benefits from it, but it's not their homes. I mean, this is like, why doesn't everybody in the United States have a referendum as to whether we get to take every penny in your pocket? Of course we're going to all vote for it, because we're not losing. You are. So that just struck me as, I mean, it's another example of what we're talking about with this colonialism. The people there, their lives are going to be destroyed by this road. And it's going to go in for the economic interests of others. That's really, if we cut past everything else and we get really to the bottom line, it's that empire is about gaining power at the expense of others. That's it. At the expense of the lives of others and their ability to live.
And how about, let's talk about cities, because it's interesting to me. I've heard you speak about cities in the past and write in your different books about this, metropolitan centers, obviously their impact on the environment, but also before I even thought in terms of the environment, I always sort of looked at cities in a strange way, and I don't know if this was intuition, I don't know if this was just being a curious kid, but I used to always ask my parents, how does everybody get everything here? I was just interested in these tall skyscrapers, and my dad was an iron worker, so he put them together in Chicago for over 30 years.
Did they really walk up there without?
Yeah. Protection? Oh, yeah. Not only do they walk up there without protection, but 45, 50, 60 stories in the air, they're drinking Strohs and smoking joints. And this was back in the 70s and 80s when things were looser. But, yeah, he was that's what they did. That's definitely what they did. They're wild. I mean, I get on a 20-foot ladder and I'm ready to get down. So I couldn't imagine that, but
I've seen so many pictures of them, and it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I don't understand how. I mean, even on the ground, I couldn't walk on a plank. You know, a plank that's what 18 inches wide or something. You know, I couldn't walk along that without at some point, you know, during the day, I'm on a trip somewhere.
Right. Right.
Anyway. But that wasn't your point.
No. The point I was simply making was, I'll be concise. I was just thinking about cities in general. You know, how did they get the materials there? Where'd they come from? How do all these people eat, sleep, you know, crap, pee in this building, and where does it go? I was always interested in that in some way or another. And then as I got older, and my family moved to Northwest Indiana from the southeast side of Chicago. I had friends whose parents had acres and acres of land, and, you know, we'd be back there partying and hanging out and walking, and I met people who hunted for the first time, and people who were just interested in the environment, interested in nature, and I was opened up to a different world. And then when I was opened up to that world and progressed as an individual, started to think a little bit more about my place in the world, what the environment meant to me, and so on. Then when I would go to cities, I almost became disgusted. Obviously, they're cultural centers in one sense because, you know, if you want to go see a concert, if you want to go to a restaurant, whatever. But in another sense, I always looked at the city and I'd be like, man, I can't wait to get the hell out of here. Like, I just need to be back by some trees. And, you know, at least, I mean, I live in a house, obviously, but it's like it was that sense of like, this is not comfortable. This is not natural. This is, and now understanding that it's just not sustainable.
Right. Well, I think it's really great that you had that realization as a child. And I think that so often that, you know, it's the issues are not cognitively challenging in terms of You know, when I was in second grade, there was a subdivision went in right next to where I lived, and it destroyed the habitat of, you know, meadowlarks, and it destroyed the homes. You know, it destroyed all these of grasshoppers and garter snakes and crawdads and cottonwood trees, and their homes were put over. And I remember thinking as a kid, this can't go on forever, because if you keep building in more places, you're going to run out of room. And I mean, I understood this as a kid, and then, you know, somehow lost track of it for a while in the middle. And, you know, it's great that you had that as a kid and that you've been able to hold on to that, because that's a question. You know, I've had so many debates with people who said, there was an article in the New York Times not very long ago or somewhere, some huge magazine, might have been New York Times, about how New York is the greenest place on earth, and or greenest place in North America, whatever. And
I wonder if they've ever been to New York.
Yeah, with somebody from New York who's writing it. And the reasoning was because when you pack people in like that, they actually use fewer resources per capita than if somebody lives in a suburb and they drive. But it's crazy for many reasons. One reason it's crazy is because, I'm sorry, the greenest place in North America is probably the middle of a wilderness area. You know, so first off, they've erased those entirely. But at the same time, some of the greenest places in America would be places where there are still indigenous peoples living at least somewhat traditionally. But setting those aside, setting all those concerns aside, there's another problem with this, which is that just exactly what you asked. And this is what I've gotten in arguments with people from cities, from people like sustainable cities. I say, look, I have no problem with you saying that cities can be less unsustainable than they are now, but how do you argue that a city can be sustainable? Because where does the food come from, like you said? Where does the poop go? Where do you get the building materials? Where do you get the energy? And it's all based on ignoring context and also ignoring physical reality. And there was a guy I had a big argument with a couple of years ago who, when I was saying, where do you get the where do you get the electricity? Where do you get the metals? And he was saying that it's possible to have 100% metals recycling and sustainably. And okay, first off, do we even need to talk about the horrors of electronics recycling, you know, which involve, you know, 10-year-old children working in toxic conditions, and the reason they're having to work is because their family's been pushed off their land so that people from the cities can have what was on the land. Okay, so there's one. To recycle aluminum, you have to heat it up to 650 degrees Celsius. And how do you do that sustainably? And also, metals recycling is incredibly toxic. There's a steel recycling plants are there's one south of Seattle where the groundwater is now more toxic than drain cleaner, and that's a necessary effect. They require and produce these horrible, nasty chemicals. And all this stuff is ignored in all of the discussion of this. And also, there's simply not enough. There's a great quote on a copper recycling website that is, or on a copper mining website, which is that copper is essentially 100% recyclable. Doesn't mean it doesn't cost energy, but it's 100% recyclable. But basically, even with 100% recycling, that would only cover, you know, X percent of the demand, which requires, means you still need, there's more copper being used every year. The demand for aluminum is supposed to go up by the USGS, I believe, predicts it will go up, it will more than double it, like go up 167% between now and 2025. And so recycling won't work in those cases anyway. Where do you get the materials? Where do you get the bricks? Where do you get the electricity to run the brick kiln? And on and on and on. They're huge. They've always been. I mean, this gets to the core of empire. What empire is about and what cities are about is a center which takes resources from the outside and brings them in. And that's what a city is. That's what an empire is. And in fact, the word civilization actually comes from the same root as it comes from the word civitatis, which means city or state. It actually comes from the root of cities. Cities are the origination of civilizations, and cities are the originations of empires. and that comes through to today. Where do the people in, you know, New York City get their fish? Where do they get their, or if they're going to be vegetarians, where do they get their grains? They come from Iowa. You know, they come from South America. They come from Ghana, you know. They come from somewhere else, because you sure can't make it in the city.
Right, right. Or, I mean, just asking the question, how in the hell we have avocados in January. I think that's – I mean, that's just simple stuff that just goes without saying. You know, you just – until you think about this stuff, you don't ask that question. You know, you don't realize that in 1954 – I believe 1953, 1954, when the CIA went into Guatemala and opened up the markets for United Fruit Company. It's like, you know, that thousands of people died so Americans can have access to cheap fruit.
Right.
That's, I mean, as serious as it gets.
You probably know the numbers better than I, but I don't think it's thousands. I think it's hundreds of thousands, isn't it, Guatemala?
Yes, oh, well, over time, yes, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, because it's over. I mean, how many years was the whole?
Well, let's go. I mean, they just released. I know Amy Goodman had a good report a couple months ago about some of the experiments the CIA were doing with folks down in Guatemala. Different shots, different vaccines, infecting them with different venereal diseases. Pretty nasty stuff, about as nasty as it gets.
I really like my agent. He's great. And his politics are wonderful. And it's so funny, you know, I've never talked publicly about 9/11, and honestly, I don't have much of an opinion about it. And the reason I don't have much of an opinion is because I asked my agent, you know, how do you deal with this if people bring it up? Because a lot of people get really, really upset if you don't really want to talk about it. And he has the best answer of all, which is, we don't need for the United States government to have blown up those buildings to know that the United States commits atrocities against citizens human beings all over the planet, whether they're, you know, people from Guatemala or people from the United States. And my point in bringing all this up is just what you're talking about is just a great example of empire and of this belief that you can attempt to, that these others, the world over, are inferior and can therefore be exploited.
Well, and the
dehumanization. Which really gets to the core of empire too, because it's not merely about, you know, this Robert J. Lifton wrote about how, something he called claims to virtue, which is, he said, before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is actually not an atrocity, but instead beneficial. So the Nazis weren't exterminating Jews. They were purifying the Aryan race. And they weren't manifesting. They weren't committing genocide. They were manifesting their destiny. And it's the same today, that the United States never, never, never actually invades a country. What they do is send in peacekeepers or send in a stabilizing force, or they bring freedom and democracy to the country. And it's the same with this. It's all fully rationalized. Even doing such openly horrendous things as what you were just saying, that's all fully rationalized. And it's based on the notion that you're superior and they're inferior.
And the only thing I was going to add to that was the dehumanization process. We see that now. It's a well-funded campaign that folks are now writing books about with regards to defaming Muslims and Arabs, but also the process that one in the military has to go through in order to be sent 10,000 miles away from home to kill people. They have to be brown. They have to be Muslims. They have to be sand N-words. As we've seen that word come up again now with Rick Perry. So, you know, again, this whole race, this idea of race, this idea of dehumanization, this idea of conquering anyone who's inferior, not only at the state level, or at the city, rural level, but, you know, at the level of patriarchy and race and ethnicity and culture.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the difficulty, is that within this culture, within this patriarchy, this obsession with exploitation is actually sort of seared into identity itself. Within this patriarchy, how you become a man is by declaring someone else to be inferior and therefore violable, and then violating them. That's the essence of masculinity in this culture. Not biological maleness. I'm not saying that, you know, having a penis makes one do this. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that within this patriarchy, how we define ourselves is as superior to these others whom we can therefore violate. And it's two things with this. One of them is that this is true on the national level too. This is where you get American exceptionalism, that the United States has this divine imperative to manifest this destiny, this divine imperative to show others this one way to be, which involves violating their ways to be, changing their ways to be, declaring them to be sand N-words, and then invading their countries, invading their communities. And one of the things that then happens is that when you do this violation, it validates — that sound in the background is my dog tripping over a plate. He's very, very old, and he's pretty much deaf and blind. When you violate these others, this then validates your superiority, because you were able to violate them, and it then also validates that this is the way things should be, because, you know, I was able to do this, so obviously it's the way it's supposed to go. And there's a few problems with this, apart from the fact that, of course, those you violate are other beings who have suffered because of you. But another problem with it is that this conquest, this need to validate one's own experience by violating another, this need to make one's identity by violating another, it doesn't really serve the purposes of validating an identity. And it's like the psychiatrist R.D. Lang said, how do you plug a void plugging a void? And, you know, if you're trying to plug a hole inside of you using something that doesn't work to fill that hole, you're going to have to keep doing it forever because it's not working. And in addition, if you're needing to violate, because you need to conquer everything, remember that the game Risk, you know, you need to win the whole thing. And so if your identity is based on making sure that you're powerful enough to take over everything, then there is always someone else new to violate, which means you can never be sufficiently omnipotent. And this, by the way, also is why science, they have to explore the deepest folds of — they have to send probes to the deepest folds of the ocean. And this is why they have to bomb the moon. It's like, why are they bombing the moon? Well, because the moon's out there and it has to be violated.
Sure.
It has to be conquered.
Sure.
We're going to conquer space. You know, it's going to conquer everything. Going to try to, at least.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a good point too. That we're gonna — I don't know if I'm kind of hoping that the limitations arise before the conquering commences, to be honest with you, or ends. I'm sorry. I don't want to be around for that. Colonies on other planets and things like this.
Well, that's not gonna happen.
No,
it's not gonna happen.
No.
Because this culture's not gonna last very long for a number of reasons. One is that the energy's not there. They won't be able to keep this up much longer. And the planet's dying. And the only good news is that we're seeing the end of this culture through peak oil. I mean, this is depression that's not going to end, this current one.
Right.
And I actually saw a great sign from the Wall Street takeover today. Somebody sent me a picture of this.
I was going to get your thoughts on that. I don't mean to cut you off, but please go into that a little bit more if you could. If you just want to touch on what you think that means, if that means anything to you, what you thought, so on.
Oh, sure. A couple things. One is the sign I saw that made me really happy was a sign that had — it was on the ground, and it had arrows pointing in all directions, so basically everything you see. And then the sign said, this is what the collapse of civilization looks like. And this is what, in both a good and bad sense, this is what the end of empire looks like. The End of Empire looks like declining expectations. There was Edward Gibbon wrote the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and there's a great line I remember ever since I was 17 or 19 or whenever it was, that is, he was describing empires. The eternal round of, now that I said it, I can't remember. Vigor, greatness, discord. The eternal round of vigor, greatness, degeneracy, discord, and decay. But that's what happens to every empire, basically, that it starts off sort of with this energy, it goes out, and then it it is great. See, there we go. There's that word, a great empire. Actually, it should be a terrible empire. You know, it should be a horrible. It should be an atrocity-inducing empire, but we'll use the word, the great empire, and then there starts to be discord, and the discord comes because the empire has reached its peak, and there we go. It's reached its, you know, it's that's high. That's supposed to be a good thing. Anyway, the empire has gotten as big as it's going to be, and then after that, there's declining expectations, which lead to discord, which leads to people fighting because there's we're not used to losing resources. We want the American dream to keep getting bigger and bigger, and when it's not getting bigger and bigger, when the pie isn't getting bigger and bigger for us to all take pieces of, then we're going to start looking for scapegoats. We're going to start looking for, you know, whom we can blame for the problems. And we're going to start getting really, really upset because I don't have the same retirement package that my parents did, whatever. And then the empire falls apart because it can't maintain. This is just, this is the natural cycle, the unnatural cycle of empires. And there's a really good book that you might want to check out about this, called, by Joseph Tainter, called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And it's how this is entirely predictable. This is what happens to a civilization. Everybody knows this. But anyway, back to the Wall Street thing. But I think it's actually great. It has surprised me because it's at least seemed really spontaneous, and I didn't think that it would actually be able to maintain. But it's taking off, which makes me absolutely delighted. And it really seems to be picking up momentum. And this, I was just going to write an essay that began, you know, I've always said that we don't live in a democracy, that, you know, the corporations control everything. But there's a sense in which we do live in a democracy, and it's not a good sense. And I was going to say this, I was going to write this essay because of the rise of the Tea Party. I didn't see any equivalent on the left at all. In terms of power, I'm not talking about the Koch brothers. Yeah, it's grass, it's AstroTurf, all that stuff. But that doesn't alter the fact that in the community where I live, the Tea Party is able to really mobilize people. And just a couple weeks ago, the Board of Supervisors, that's our equivalent of county commissioners, our Board of Supervisors meeting, they had to call the cops twice on the Tea Party people because there were so many of them and they were so vociferous. And they were there to try to get, the county to privatize waste management. And that's extraordinary that they're able to get that many people out. Honestly, in this community, the last time that many people showed up at a Board of Supervisors meeting was when they tried to reduce the number of medical marijuana plants you can have.
Sure.
And then all the medical marijuana and the potheads all showed up in mass. And the point is that, yeah, people will show up for those things, and the right-wingers are showing up for those things, and the left-wingers are showing up for marijuana, but nobody's showing up for the salmon, you know, in this community. Nobody's showing up for the natural world. So I was going to write about how I think we do live in a democracy because most people honestly don't care about the natural world, and most people honestly would rather have the American dream. More people show up to see a Detroit Tigers baseball game than care about real tigers.
Sure.
And I like sports, but that's not the fact that this is really weird. You can get 100,000 people at a college football game, and, you know, if you want something to protect the Gulf of Mexico, you're going to get 16. It's just – so I was going to write about that. And then this whole Wall Street thing is making me reconsider because this is great. There's a lot of people showing up all over the country. And this is one of those sort of, you know, the movie Network ideas where this is, I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take this anymore.
All right.
That's great. And when people are speaking out against corporate control, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. This is you know, and I wonder how much of this do you think is inspired by the whole Arab Spring? You know, maybe I mean, I'm seeing a lot of signs. They're like, you know, help us Egyptians and, you know, bring Cairo to New York City. It's great. It's great stuff. This is like, and, you know, we can talk about some of the, you know, how the, some of the ones in the North African nations have not, I mean, I hope that they continue and that they win further victories. So, you know, they've certainly, there's a lot further for, lot more ways for them to go. But, you know, I hope that this keeps going all over the world.
No, I agree. I mean, on one level, I absolutely agree. I think that I think this is, it's excellent. There's obviously a lot of people who out there, including Chicago, Occupy Chicago, who haven't been involved before. The only thing I would say was I was in Wisconsin, and that was in the midst of the Arab Spring, and I was in Madison for about a week and a half during those protests, organizing and setting up events. And, you know, I think on one level, I would say please write the article, for one, because I think there's something on the left that bothers me after being involved for a short time, but the last 5 years since I've been out of the Marine Corps, there's a lot of people who are willing to cheerlead different events, and there were people in Wisconsin, and I thought it was awesome. I mean, again, I was inspired. I was motivated enough to stay there for a week and a half and almost get booted out of my second semester of school. But, you know, so, I mean, I didn't care. I mean, at that point, I thought it was amazing. But most of the organizers that I was hanging around with, we tried to keep a critical eye, and I'm inclined to do the same with Wall Street and Occupy Chicago. I've been telling everybody and their mother to go out and support the event in any way they can. But in the meantime, I think when I get together with other organizers, when I get together with activists who are serious, if I'm talking to someone such as yourself, I think it's just really important that we maintain folks who are on the left and who, in a solidarity message, can be critical. I don't mean in this sort of blowing them off and whatever, this or that. I mean in a serious, sophisticated, critical fashion, to talk about the good things that are happening, but in the same breath, to be able to talk about how there's many steps that we need to take, and we need to build on this momentum and not let it get sucked into the electoral vacuum like it did in Wisconsin.
That's a hugely important point. I think one of the huge things we have to watch out for is to make sure that the
this is an election year, by the way. I don't mean to interrupt you, but
That's exactly the point. What we need to do, I think, be absolutely vigilant to not allow this to be co-opted by the Democratic Party and make sure that it's not just taken right back into the same old, you know, have some nice language but still support corporations that the Democrats have been doing for, you know, certainly for my lifetime.
Sure. The only other thing I was going to add is if you want to check out somebody who's been doing great work, just released a book on the Tea Party. His name's Paul Street. He writes for Z Magazine, writes for some other folks, Counterpunch. It's called Crashing the Tea Party. He's a great author, public intellectual from South Side of Chicago, worked extensively with the Urban League, and he was writing books about Obama about 4 or 5 years before it became cool to criticize Obama. So he was basically on Obama from the day he was a state senator to the day he came to office as the president, and he's released about 2 or 3 books on Obama and what he was going to do.
Wow.
And he was right on the money with that, and so were the folks, just on an aside, because I like to give these guys shout-outs, the folks at Black Agenda Report, Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford, have both been on Obama since the day he was a state senator, and they started talking about him back in 2004 as a possible candidate. So I do want to say there are folks on the left, a lot of folks, in my opinion, whose voices were silenced, who have been doing critical work in that regard for some time.
Right.
And the last thing, because we are coming up to an hour, but I do want to get your thoughts on this, because I thought it was a great collection of interviews. Last year, you and publisher PM Press released a book entitled Resistance Against Empire. This contains personal interviews you conducted with some of the leading thinkers on the left and a few of my favorites, Christian Parenti, Robert McChesney, and Alfred McCoy. I was going to ask you what your motivation was to put this together, and what did you learn from this experience? Any thoughts or commentary?
It's another great question. You always ask really good questions. And in this case, I just wanted to put the interviews together to have them out in the public in a one volume set. And so my motivation was simply to get the information out there. And the what I learned, you know, it's hard to say, because those interviews are a while ago, and a lot of them were really, the reason it's hard to say is because a lot of them really helped inform my positions on a lot of these questions. You know, Christian Parenti, when I talked to him, it was all about, I already knew a bit about the whole prison industrial complex, but he really helped me, he articulated, and he told about the history of how Highway Patrol, actually even the word comes from the patrollers, who were white people in the South who would patrol around and try to and hunt down slaves. And, I didn't know any of that history before. And he talks about the relationship between penitentiaries and slave camps. And, I understood, I understand, prison labor is bad, but I didn't understand it the way he put it forward. I didn't really, really understand it. And the same with McChesney, I've been complaining about the media for 20 years and been reading media analysis for 20 years. And then McChesney just made it, he helped crystallize, it's kind of like if you have some sickness, this is what the book did for me. If you have some, you've got symptoms, you don't have a sickness, you got symptoms, you feel like, oh, I don't know. So, I was reading about this one time that you have low libido and nothing gives you pleasure at all, and you have brain fog and you have night sweats, and it's like, why is this all happening to me? And then you get a blood test and you find out that it's because you got low testosterone, and so you need to, put on testosterone cream, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. So the point is, there was this constellation of symptoms that you didn't know why you had, and all of a sudden you get a label for these symptoms, like, oh, okay, I understand. Actually, an example from my own life is I got, there's diarrhea, there's fatigue, there's all sorts of other things. It's like, what's going on? I don't understand what's wrong. And I learned I have Crohn's disease. Once you get the diagnosis, it's really bad that you got some bad diagnosis. But on the other hand, it's like, okay, now I understand the symptoms. It's like a doctor friend of mine said, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And it was the same with all those interviews. It's like, there's something wrong with the whole prison thing. I don't know what it is. And Parenti was able to make that clear for me. And McCoy, I wish I would have interviewed McCoy many years later. I wish I should interview him again, actually, because I would love to interview him about torture, since he wrote a book on that.
Yeah.
And he's just a fabulous, fabulous intellectual and analyst. And so I didn't really know until I read his book, The Politics of Heroin, I didn't know how the whole CIA relationship to heroin works. And basically, just very simple, in a very, very, in a nutshell, the way it worked historically is that the CIA would not actually run the drugs for the most part, but instead they would make an enforcement free zone. And he gave the example of what would happen if suddenly the police gave you, Derek, an exception and said you could be a bank robber. You could have a bank robbery free zone where you, Derek, could be the only person who gets to rob banks and nothing's going to happen to you. You can walk in and say, look, give me $10,000. You can do it every day. And they're just like, well, of course you're going to go in and do it every day. And that's what the United States would do with various drug lords is in Southeast Asia, in Afghanistan, all over the world, they would be saying, okay, if you be a CIA asset and if you give us information about, these people, like, if you're in Southeast Asia, so if you help us out with the you know, trying to conquer Vietnam, then we will ignore your drug running. And of course, drug running is a, you know, a way to make a lot of money. So, you know, you do that to 50 different groups, and at least some of them are going to become drug runners because they want the money. And I didn't understand how that worked. I just knew vague, you know, yeah, CIA, drugs, but I didn't understand how it worked. And it's the same with all the people in the book. They just, they helped me, and helped me so much to understand the various symptoms, how the symptoms of these, of this culture fit into one giant sickness.
Well, and I'll make a personal aside about the sale of drugs overseas. A kilo of heroin goes for $15,000 on the streets of Kandahar. However, that same kilo on the streets of Moscow goes for $120,000 a piece. So you can damn well believe in it, that the CIA and generals and higher ranking military officials, and of course, gangs from both Afghanistan, the region, and Russia are enjoying the profits of 10 years worth of direct occupation and distribution of heroin and poppy. At the same time, Hamid Karzai, one of the brothers of one of the largest drug cartel leaders in the country, is our appointed puppet master and prime minister. So I think, you know, talking to McCoy now, it's actually a guy I've got on my list that I want to interview for the program. But I have a friend who is also a mentor, fellow Marine, Vietnam era veteran, Professor Kim Sipes, is friends with Professor McCoy. So hopefully that'll be an easy connect there. You know, I'm going to end with this, because when I saw that book, I enjoyed the fact that you showcased people's work on the left. And this is something somebody today after the program I did said, you know, you really have to be humble to just sit back and listen. I probably more with you than other folks actually jump in and say things, because you remind me of certain things to say or you ask me questions. But I've always enjoyed the fact that you're willing to showcase other people's work. And I think the coolest thing about, for me, getting this radio program was not only can I plug people in at the community level and showcase the work of activists and organizers, but then on a personal level, or on just, you know, something that I'm personally interested in on an intellectual level, talking with folks like yourself, talking with Noam Chomsky. I finally did get a hold of Ward Churchill and his folks, and he's going to be on the program hopefully later this month. And, you know, it's like, I just really enjoyed that, because there's not a lot of folks on the left. First of all, many of them are, you know, part of sectarian Marxist groups and so on and so forth, whatever they are, anarchists, Leninists, Trotskyists, whatever. But I always enjoy, to be short, I always enjoy someone who can recognize that there's people out there who are doing amazing work, and then having the ability or the platform to showcase that work like you have. I really appreciate that on a personal level, and as someone who does work on the left.
Well, thanks for saying that, and thanks for noticing that. And obviously, I can say the exact same thing back to you, that I really appreciate that about you, and you conduct really great interviews.